no cup for Canada.
The drought continues.
I can both simultaneously feel bad for Edmonton fans. Like, I had friends who flew out to Florida. Well, their reactions were kind of what I expected. Or not expected, sorry, but that they, I had people that were soaking it in and still enjoying the experience. And because they came back from down three games, I feel like it wasn't as heartbreaking for many people. Not everyone. I'm sure there are Oilers fans out there that are absolutely obliterated today. Crushed, shattered. But you faced your death. And then you got a second chance at life. And so when death came back around, you went, well, the prognosis was for a month and I got to live another 5 years. How could I be that sad? How could I be that crushed about it? But yeah, I can both simultaneously feel bad for Oilers fans, but now once it's over, I'm a little relieved that the Leafs got another shot at being the first team to win the Stanley Cup in Canada since 1993. Get that moniker. Get that first cup. This cup is a big cup. That would have been a massive one. There would have been basically nothing that another Canadian team could have done to match what Connor McDavid would have accomplished with his Edmonton Oilers coming back down from 0-3. There was also a part of me. I got to admit, it's just, I'm a complicated sports fan, okay? I'm not as binary as some of you. I don't like the Florida Panthers, okay? I don't root for their team. But I felt some empathy for their players going, every single one of you is just going to be remembered as a loser. Back-to-back losses, and you blow that lead. You go into the Atlanta Falcons 28-3 Hall of Fame. You're the way that we remember Matt Ryan. You're the way that we remember Julio Jones. Hell, you might even be bigger losers. They could make the case that 28-3 was one game. You lost four? Oof, I don't know. And I think one thing we didn't realize in that game, or one thing that seemed a little obvious, was that Florida, they started to look themselves, because maybe they had played multiple games with the cup in the building and the cup on the line, whereas this was Edmonton's first where they could have won it. But yeah, Florida's a deserving team, man. They were I think that Edmonton was the highest ceiling team, that when they were at their best, and you saw it in the series, they could just cave in anyone. When McDavid was playing at his very tippity top, there was just no stopping them. Like, game five, I thought, was Florida's to win. And what was the story of that game? It was, even as they were starting to get momentum, even as Florida started to push, McDavid came out there and stopped the momentum. McDavid would come out and make another brilliant play. That's the one, that's the game where he splits the two and banks it over to Corey Perry for a goal. He was the ace. Like I said, he was the stopper. He was like the NBA player. He was LeBron James. You couldn't stop him from getting to the hole. He looked like LeBron against a G League team. But Florida was the most consistent. And I liked that it was a very Florida Panthers-y way to win. The forecheck returned. They felt dangerous. They took away the middle of the ice, and Bobrovsky was making saves, and Alex Barkov was brilliant. And I'm in the minority when it comes to the Conn Smythe. I understand. Thank you to everyone who replied to my tweet to inform me that it wasn't just an award for the final. I wasn't aware. And to those of you that asked if I watched the game or the series, no, I didn't. I actually did this all on fraud. I just watched the highlights, and that's what I picked up. I thought Barkov was Conn Smythe, and I was actually happy to see. I saw 16 of the 17 voters, Armin, voted for Connor McDavid to win it. And I think that the only vote was the other vote for Barkov. I didn't even see it. It wasn't. It was for Bob, right? I think when I tweeted that, everyone was under the assumption that I thought it was Bobrovsky because he had the three awesome games and he helped win them the three games, blah, 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 blah. And McDavid only had two incredible games that really won the Oilers their contest. And so that was the match. No, Let's balance this out on the entire playoff run. McDavid's run was special. There's just no doubt about it. It was incredible. He's a deserving Conn Smythe winner. I really don't like that he didn't go out and get the award. I don't know why there was like celebrating of that. Like the only guy I remember ever getting it in a loss was J.S. Giguere, and it's a famous photo of him going out teary-eyed and weary after going and getting it. And like, I'm not crying. I'm not filling my pants about it. I'm not like, oh McDavid, what does this say about his character? Like, yeah, he's mad he didn't go out. Whatever. But you're the face of the league, and this was one of the biggest games in straight-up NHL history. I think that you should have gone out and grabbed the award. You should have looked pissed off, and you should have grabbed the award, and we should have been able to look at you and go, hey, he hates that he has this, rather than get the post-game audio clip of him saying that he hated it. But he kind of no-showed in 6 and 7. I don't know why people are so upset about that. Like, he had one near chance in game 7, which was like a deflection that he flew over the net, and it was when the game was over. Like, sorry, not the game was over, but when the Florida Panthers were playing a different style of hockey, they were basically conceding icings. That was a score effects moment. McDavid wasn't really present in that game through the first two periods. I thought he looked tight. He wasn't really around. He had no shots in game 6. And I do think there's two things can be true. McDavid was unreal. He broke a Gretzky record, although he did play 7 more games than the year Gretzky that we're referencing. Like, that's a full series more. It just should be noted, okay? It's not I'm not like discrediting it. It's just something of note. I thought that a lot of Oilers had really great moments throughout the playoff run. Draisaitl was incredible early on in the playoff run. Like, if we're doing the whole, like, well, it's the entire playoffs thing, you could have argued Draisaitl was their best player early in the postseason. Skinner had moments in the postseason. Bouchard had moments in the postseason. Hyman had moments in the postseason. Like, I do think it's a little disingenuous, just a little. McDavid's the best player who had the best run, who was unreal, but it's a little disingenuous to just say like it was all him and that the rest of the Oilers were bums. I thought that a lot of the Oilers had really good cup runs. I really did. But the reason why I thought it was Barkov was encapsulated in that final 10 minutes. Edmonton is pressing, and every single time Connor McDavid goes over the boards, guess who's there right with him? Alex Barkov. Guess who dominated him in the dot? Guess who won every single faceoff against McDavid, winning possession over and over? Barkov. You know what I thought was the critical moment of the final third period that won't get enough credit? Is when Barkov wins multiple offensive zone faceoffs against McDavid, controls the puck, and they basically ended up killing the clock from 6-something to 4-something. He was unreal, breaking up plays. There's a reason why the best player on planet Earth kind of disappeared in 2 games, and it was Alex Barkov. And he did it to everyone on that run. He did it to every single star on the run. You can look at their stats, and they got depleted. And if you take out those 2 games, which I know always kind of sounds like a Dumbo thing to say, because those points do matter. But when push came to shove, when the Panthers won games, they slowed down McDavid, and it was that guy that did it. And I thought he deserved his due. And in general, I am a give the Conn Smythe to the winning team or to the winning team's player guy. I'm not a huge fan of the runner-up. It's just the way I feel about it. I know Versteeg is on the line. He feels differently about it. He was very much like, he texted me McDavid after, I think, game 5. Either way, I just really hope people remember how great Alex Barkov was, even though the points and the goals don't pop off the sheet at you, because I will genuinely remember that Panthers Stanley Cup more as the Barkov run than it was the Bobrovsky one. Anyways, Chris Versteeg, 2-time Stanley Cup champion, creator of the Clever app, which again, if you're involved in new sports or any sports of any kind, you should go check out. It's free to download. How are we doing, buddy? What's going on? Sorry about Alberta.
Yeah, poor Alberta. You know, again.
Close.
Again.
Game 7, close.
Game 7, one away, but I still remember talking to you after that Dallas game, game 6, when Bouchard rimmed it around with 11 seconds left and didn't eat it. Mm-hmm. And those details, I felt, were going to kill him, and boy, did they kill him in game 7.
So what do you think happened in game 7 then? Because the Oilers were so dominant, they looked like they were carrying all this momentum. And I know people say that momentum doesn't go game to game, but it sure felt like that in this series. And then all of a sudden, the Florida Panthers returned and looked like their jolly old selves.
You know, when the whole momentum doesn't carry game to game started, by the way, when John Tortorella went on a rant. and everyone started to feed into, oh, it doesn't go game to game. Momentum definitely does go game to game. Now, you still have to play the game because momentum's built on belief. So when belief builds game to game, momentum carries. So looking at the game, though, is that what your question was?
Yeah, sorry? Yeah, about the game.
Yeah. Looking at the game, I don't know what Bouchard was doing the entirety of the night. Mm-hmm. If you look at the end of that penalty kill, I don't know why he's on the penalty kill at the end of that PK. He gets the puck. He has time to dump it out. He chips it for some reason to McLeod. And McLeod then overskates it, doesn't get the puck out. Then the puck stays in. Bouchard gets kind of caught in no man's land. And then the goal goes in. Multiple plays throughout the night. It was just, and it fed into game one. I felt very much like that with him in game one and game two as well. And especially in game seven, right? Like, I just thought Bouchard was not on his game all series. I know he gets his points. Mm-hmm. He gets his power play points. But it was frustrating to watch that guy play yesterday more than any other game for me. Mm-hmm. And that to me was a big piece of the detail. And then, you know, watching Kulak back in on that goal, like it was minor hockey where a D-man just backs into his goalie. Those are two big details of the game that lost him the game.
So, yeah, I don't think Bouchard had the best series. I think that's pretty clear. Like he
was tough to watch.
Yeah, it was a big, like, I would say that if we were looking at this through the lens of, like, I did legacy stakes yesterday. I didn't have Bouchard on my list, but I had, say, Verhaeghe and Reinhardt and Tkachuk because I went, man, none of these guys have produced. Tkachuk had 2 points in the series. Going into that game, Reinhardt had one goal and two assists, and Verhaeghe had a goal and was a -9. So,
yeah,
huge shifter for those guys. And I think it would have been kind of a similar thing with Bouchard where, you know, he got, yeah, he wasn't at his very best. I would do wonder if he ended up being injured or whether or not some of that was attention to detail stuff. But either way, like it swings pretty hard for him.
I think Bouchard lacks attention to detail
That's
all over the ice. And Ekholm is as elite as it comes as a defender. Yeah. When you look at Hughes on Vancouver, Hughes is obviously more mobile than Bouchard, doesn't have the big bomb like Bouchard. But why did Hughes struggle for 4 or 5 years after Tanev left? Mm-hmm. Similar to Ekholm. Ekholm is, I remember playing against Ekholm in the league. He is one of the most elite defenders. He closes time and space. He makes great plays and he makes the guy he plays with better. Whether it was Josi, whether it was all these guys, he is an elite defender and he just cleans up all the mistakes. Now, I love like when Bouchard on the power play and how he gets his shots through, but he is the guy that makes Bouchard click. Mm. And throughout those games and throughout the series, when I'm watching Oilers games, it's the details to Bouchard's game that hurt them. But obviously, it's the offense that helps them. So they got to live and die with that, which I totally understand and get. But in a game seven, you got to be dialed into the details. And Florida was dialed into the details. Did you see any of their guys take any chances at any points, at any moment of the game?
No, even like, the only penalty they gave up was a joke of a call.
Yeah, it was an absolute joke.
So, yeah, no, I thought that, again, the Panthers looked like themselves. That was the classic Panthers script, was forecheck, look heavy in the offensive zone, take away the middle of the ice, and then Barkov makes your star disappear. And so this is...
Here's another thing I didn't touch on, though, JD, is about the feeling of when the cup's in the building. I think we talked about it last week.
Yeah.
Florida had that first-time feeling in Game 4, and they struggled with it. It's 8-1. Yeah. Then all of a sudden, the momentum and all that starts to build. This was the first time the Oilers ever got to feel that pressure.
Yeah, and you could win it.
That they could win it. And that was the first time that they ever had to live through that pressure of, hey, man, you know, we were playing with house money and we're playing all free. It's kind of like those teams that after they're out of the playoffs, the young guys come up and they play great and they start beating teams that are supposed to be Stanley Cup contenders. So that, when it's that real and the cup's in the building, that was the first time the Edmonton Oilers ever had to feel that anxiety or that angst of sitting there for 2 days and like, holy man, like, this is the biggest game. We can win the Stanley Cup. So they played that game like it was like the Stanley Cup was in the building, obviously, right? They played with that angst, that anxiety, that tightness. And you could see it. Connor felt that way. Even on that 5-on-4 when that stick broke, Connor was still forcing plays through the seam. And I'm like, man, there's a stick broke. And then he wheeled the net and he tried to force it to Draisaitl. And then there's a whistle where he could have kept just wheeling the net and hit Bouchard for a bomb up top. Just stuff like that where the anxiety makes you make different plays. It just does, right? Or it doesn't allow you to make plays that you want to because you're worried about turning it over.
Mm. So that's where I was kind of going next, though, is how much of that do you think is anxiety in this series versus Barkov? Because, like, yeah, I know that you want to point to Bouchard, and I get it because he wasn't at his very best in the series, and he made some critical mistakes for this team at critical times. But ultimately, McDavid won a Conn Smythe without his team winning a Stanley Cup. This is a team that is ultimately predicated on the success of two players, and McDavid in the final two games of the series ends up with two whole shots. And I got to say, through the first two periods of that hockey game last night, like I barely noticed him until all of a sudden Edmonton was gearing up and, you know, piling it on the last 10 minutes of the game where they just decided that he was going to play just about every shift.
Yeah. Well, what's the question? Should he have won the Conn Smythe?
Well, it's both. It's like, let's start with this. Is like, what happened to him and Draisaitl the last two games?
Well, Draisaitl was non-existent the entire series. So is he injured? Was there reports that came out that he had rib issues or something?
I don't know what it was, but I texted you that game six, he came out and looked like a house on fire to start the game. Yeah. And I went, oh, what, like they gave you a shot? There's a miracle cure? And then I went, oh, it's got to be a shot of something because he disappeared as the game went on. Like it just looked like he went away. And I will say this is one of the scarier things actually about the Oilers in terms of the we'll be back narrative is they've got to decide on his contract, and I know they're going to want him back. Like, they're not walking away from Leon Draisaitl, and he's an amazing player. You can re-sign him. You do it. He had a great quote about being thrilled to share the ice with McDavid. I think that they are a pair, but he has gotten hurt in a few of these runs, and I do want, like, everyone talks about how McDavid will age. I'm not sure Draisaitl will age the same way. Like, I don't know if he's going to be like Sid and McDavid, where he just ages into his mid to late 30s like a fine wine. But anyway, I think it's pretty clear, given the drop-off in play, that he was hurt. McDavid wasn't, though. Like, where was he?
Yeah, I was at game six.
Yeah.
And watching, let's talk Draisaitl a sec, exactly what you said. Just watching the pop in his skate, I was like, wow, he looks like he's back. He looks fine. And like you said, it kind of dissipated over the course of the game, and he went away. Connor in that game, I thought he had moments. The game is 5-1. Maybe he's just trying to hold back a little bit to make an excuse for him.
Sure.
Make an excuse a bit. But that's what I felt.
He's the son of Alberta, and you're an Albertan. Like, you gotta do this the right way. So it's all right.
Yeah. But game seven, I do feel that there was a sense of anxiety that he was playing with. You obviously stated that Barkov did very well against him. Barkov has lived through those moments in the last, three games. You know, even watching McDavid fall, on that little tight turn, just things like that, right? Just that anxiety can build into your game. And I just don't think he was playing his game. I thought he was forcing plays all over the ice. I didn't think he was coming back to get the puck enough to bring it up with speed. And that was a thing that Kane used to do, especially to get into the game. I remember his skills coach used to say, hey, when you're not in the game, go back, get it, and start skating it to get yourself in the game. I didn't find Connor going back to get the puck enough either when he was on the ice to get into the game. And then when he did get the puck, if he was in the O-zone, he was forcing a lot of plays through the seam. Or you've seen him, I think it was in the third period, he tried to cut through three guys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you remember that? When he tried to cut through three guys instead of turning back to the boards? There's just plays like that where he wants it so much. It's his first time feeling that anxiety. I don't think he played his best game. Barkov's playing his best game defensively, and I think it was just a good concoction for the Panthers to end up winning that game. But, you look at McDavid now talking about the Conn Smythe side. Yeah, this is the same thing with the MVP rule or whatever we're talking about. The teams have to make the playoffs or in order to make the MVP. Shouldn't it just be whoever the best player in the league is regardless? Or for the Conn Smythe, if it should be the best player in the playoffs, he's the best player in the playoffs.
Yeah.
If it should go, I totally agree. I like it going to the winning team. Mm-hmm. No doubt in my mind. I think it should go to the winning team. But he was the best player in the entirety of the playoffs over the course of the last 2.5 months. So if I'm looking at that, for sure he's the Conn Smythe. I still don't like the look of it. Mm-hmm. It should, I still believe, like you said, should still go to the winning team. those are things where they've just changed the rule in its entirety. The winning team, the best player on the winning team gets the Conn Smythe.
I just think I got a couple things on it. One is it's funny. They award the cup, and Chris Cuthbert has a great call on Barkov where he goes, one of the most underrated players, maybe no longer, right? And I went, I still feel like he's underrated. Most fans thought it was Bobrovsky's to lose when it came to the Conn Smythe. So I went, no, I think that's over. No. It's Barkov. I've been praising him the entire series. After the last one, after the Eastern Conference Finals, I talked to you and said, man, that was outrageous. He had, I don't even know how many points in that series. Like none. He barely produced anything. And watching him every night was just a pleasure. He was incredible. And so they were just two guys that did different things. But Barkov came out on top. Like, McDavid got shut down for multiple games in this series. And I would say this. I wait those games more than I wait the games at the beginning. I'm sorry. Like, I just do. I'm waiting more of the points or more of the winning impact of a game where the Florida Panthers win 6-7 than I am, like, game four against the Vancouver Canucks. Like, I just am.
Yeah, you're looking for the intangibles of what it takes to win. And that's, I mean, how long have we talked about that on this show? And Barkov brought all those intangibles, game in and game out. Kopitar's done it in the past. Taze has done it in the past. Those are little things. Like, even you were talking about in your rant at the start, winning those ozone faceoffs to hem them in for a minute to kill the clock. Like, those are intangibles that certain players bring consistently night in and night out. And those teams generally win the Stanley Cup.
But that's it.
That's it, right?
Yeah, I just felt like Barkov, there were so many moments in throughout this run where I thought, well, they won because he just shut it down. Like, once they got the lead, you couldn't throw your best players over the board and have them feel the same impact because he would just kill them. And he did that the entire run. And I just thought if it was down to those two, I thought Barkov's run was as special as it gets for a defensive specialist forward. Like, I shouldn't even call him a specialist because obviously he has offensive ability. He's incredible. But, like, that run, you go and you look at the stats of the other guys, it was locked down every single night, winning plays every single night. And then his team won. And so, to me, he gets it by a hair. And also, I do think, and this part of it is kind of my actual dumb take. I don't think my Barkov take is dumb. I think it's fine to have voted for McDavid. I understand the argument for it. But I have two other parts of it. One is, I do think that we're kind of rewriting the narrative on the Oilers' run, that it was just like, all McDavid, and McDavid did everything. Yes, he dragged them back into the series single-handedly in those two games. There's just no doubt about it. But a lot of Oilers had good runs. Like, they did, man. If we're doing the entire run, we got to remember Draisaitl at the beginning of this thing before he got hurt. We got to remember some of the moments Bouchard had, some of the moments that Hyman had. Like, the team was good. Edmonton played a good brand of hockey in a lot of these games. And then two is, should it matter at all that McDavid, like, did not want that award? Like, don't you want to hand it to someone who's excited on the biggest stage? Do you want to hand it to a guy who's going to be pissed off and didn't even come out to receive the award? This is my dumb guy take, because I know it shouldn't that part really shouldn't matter. But I did feel that a little bit, where I was like, man, if you were down to it 50-50, be like, or 51-49. Give it to the guy who's going to be celebrated for having it, not the guy who's going to be sour and never even display it in his house.
Well, let's touch on the importance of the reason they even came back. Connor Brown.
Yeah.
Like, we're forgetting about Connor Brown, Matthias Janmark, Holloway. It is critical when you're talking about a hockey club that your depth guys feel important. Yeah. If you look at the entirety of the Oilers playoff runs, in big moments, depth guys stepped up. The times the Oilers had struggles throughout the playoffs, especially in the Vancouver series or other series, is when they just laid on the hammer, actually similar to Game 7, where you're looking at the minute discrepancy. Like, there's only, I think, four guys, that had over 11 minutes, 12 minutes. When you don't make the depth guys feel important, you're going to struggle. When the Oilers got their depth guys engaged, when Connor Brown was getting out there 14 minutes plus, when he's getting into the forecheck, when Holloway's in there, those guys, I think, brought them back. Like, if you look at game four, it's an 8-1 game.
Game four, McDavid put it away. He didn't start it. It was all the depth guys that got the ball rolling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then game six, Who got them? Mm-hmm. The depth guys. They got out there. They were playing the way they had to. They felt important in their roles. Game seven, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That did not happen.
And dude, this is it. I just don't like the narrative of McDavid was unreal. I'm not trying to take away from him whatsoever. The texting that I had with you after games five and six and the feeling I had, the excitement I had for him as a player, given the way that he had played, it was as good as I've ever seen a guy play. But I just don't like the narrative of it was McDavid and the bum squad, because I don't think that the Oilers were a bad hockey team. I don't think that he was just dragging a bunch of scragglers every single night. A lot of those guys deserve credit for that run, and I think that they should get it.
Yeah, and the guy who I was critical of at the start, Stuart Skinner,
yeah,
he stepped up big.
Huge.
Like they had every single guy throughout their lineup bought in, and when they were used in their roles, they came up big. And that's all you can ask for of your depth guys. They should be super proud of that team they built and the guys that dragged them back into the Vancouver series, the guys that brought them back into this series. They should be very proud about the team they built, and it wasn't just a one- or two-man show. Of course, Connor is the best player on the planet, and he can do certain things that other players can't. Their depth guys were unbelievable, and I couldn't be more proud watching those guys, when they were used in those roles, come up big. Yeah. Back to the Conn Smythe thing, when you're asking now about him, he should have went on the ice.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm glad you think so. I think he regrets it this morning. I bet you he woke up this morning and was like, whoops, I should have gone and done it.
I mean, they had the camera on his mom, and she goes, he's not coming out.
I think you could hear her say that.
Yeah, they had it on the mom. Yeah, the mom and dad, and you could kind of hear her say, he's not coming out. J.F. Chiguer came out, right?
Yep.
You remember that?
Yeah.
I believe there's a picture of J.F.
Yeah, he's got tears in his eyes, and I went, man, I want to see that. Like, I do think
Gary's got to be pissed.
That's
today.
What I'm saying. You're the face of the game, and everyone wants to know, you know, everyone now knows who Connor McDavid is. You go around, and it's like, what traction did they get throughout this run when it's being talked about on ESPN? It left First Take yesterday, for God's sakes. It's on McAfee. Everyone wants to see Connor McDavid. And so, as hard as it is in that moment, I still think that there's two things in hockey. One is that it's all about sportsmanship. You go and you do the handshake line at the end. You're not a sore loser, right? You win with grace, you lose with grace. And I don't like him not going out. Again, I don't think it's the worst thing in the universe. I don't want this to turn into some big, stupid hot take. I just really think he should have gone out, and we should have had that picture.
I can understand his mentality if he is in the room and they're like, hey, you won the Conn Smythe, and he goes, and he's thinking more of a team. If I'm not going on the ice unless it's with the cup with my team. So maybe that's where he was, and he was emotional about that. And so I understand that, but yeah, he should have gone on the ice to take the picture.
I want that image of him pissed off, accepting this award and hating it. And knowing that when we do all the ads for ESPN and for Sportsnet moving forward of Connor's pursuit of the Stanley Cup, Connor's pursuit of greatness, that you can turn that image into, and, you know, he fell just short. Like, but he wants it bad. You look at his eyes, you can see how much he hates getting one of the most prestigious awards in any sport. Like, that means something to me. I think that meant something to hockey, and not having it sucks. It just does. He should have gone out. Like, he should have gone out. I don't really think there's a case against it. You cannot be mad about it, because, like, I'm not mad about it. But if you're telling me, like, one or the other, clearly the best player in the game should have went out and stood there with one of the most important awards in sports.
I mean, if it was LeBron, he would have been out there holding it over his head.
Yeah, he would have. I mean, like, it wasn't my fault. I told, here's the proof.
but he should have gone out. And I was just thinking about Gary in that moment, just losing his mind. Because I think he was waiting to kind of see him. Hey, Connor McDavid. And then it kind of got awkward. The booze started. They put it on his mom. She's like, he ain't coming out.
Yeah.
Boom. Didn't come out.
Man, I was just, all I could think of was, this is just Gary's dream again. He was like, the ride continues, losing Canadian teams. Me getting the benefit of the Canadian run, only for one of my sweet, sweet candy babies to win Florida, you know, like a team that is getting all this praise for building up their fan base and all their fans. And I'm like, the building was half Oilers fans for their Stanley Cup final.
How about Alanis Morissette too?
Yeah, she's
at the start.
Great.
She was great on the American. She really, really downplayed the Canadian, though.
Oh, you think?
There sang it. Yeah, I didn't think she sang it very well.
No. Okay, all right. That's a little hot. She did get hit with the dual citizen thing. She was in Florida. Yeah. Maybe she felt some allegiances to them.
Wow, well, I mean, hey, let's not get political here, but she definitely sang the American anthem, I thought, with more heart.
Yeah. Okay, so a couple of the other Panthers guys. How big do you think that swing was for the guys I mentioned, Tkachuk, Reinhardt, and Verhaeghe? Because I would have made them the whipping boys this entire thing had they lost, more so than Barkov. Bobrovsky.
When you're talking legacy, I don't really ever think of Verhaeghe. Like, if Verhaeghe's I know, great guy and everything, he's not really a legacy guy to me.
Sure.
The legacy guys to me are the Tkachuks, the Hall of Famers. These are the guys that those are the names you're going to remember for the history of time in hockey. When thinking about the anxiety, though, of what they must have felt, and if they would have lost and what they would have had to go through time and time again for the next 100 years that they're, or whatever, 80 years that they're alive, whether it be on social media or just anywhere, it was giving me anxiety. Like, knowing what I went through in 2010 when we were up 2-0 and then they came back, made it 2-2, and obviously you end up winning, but like in game 6, Taze hurts his MCL. We don't know if he's going to play game 7. We go into overtime. Like, I still play back those things in my head of the what ifs if this didn't happen. So I could not have imagined being up 3-0 and, you know, losing the series 4-3 and I don't even know what the words would be, like the stress, the anxiety, and the depression. Honestly, the depression, that is a true word in this case, of what you would feel day in and day out and what you'd have to live with the rest of your life, knowing that you blew a 3-0 series lead in the Stanley Cup final. So for the legacies of the Barkovs, the Hall of Famers, the legacy for a Bobrovsky and
Tkachuk, they were the top three. I did have them yesterday when I listed. I said the biggest legacy stakes going in the game was one, McDavid, obviously. Two is Bobrovsky because he was a sniff away from Conn Smythe, and he's got two Vezinas. I've said this a million times now, but that's like Carey Price has one, right? Like Henrik Lundqvist has one.
Yeah, this solidifies him in the Hall of Fame.
What I mean is that puts him in there versus being like a Hall of Fame choker where people would have gone, yeah, he won the two Vezinas and then he stunk and then he signed a horrible contract and then he ends up the Florida run blowing it for the Panthers because he couldn't make a save. So his was huge. Barkov, obviously, again, I still feel underrated. I feel completely underappreciated player that a lot of people are just don't seem to be getting. That's why I keep drumming it. If someone's like, man, why do you talk about Barkov so much when I talk about McDavid? It's because everybody talks about McDavid. Everybody looks at McDavid, and it's very easy to identify how brilliant he is. Barkov just hasn't got it. I had Tkachuk right after that.
Think about your text to me about Kopitar. Sorry, but
No.
Like you downplaying Kopitar.
I know. But it's also, but this is me not wanting history to repeat itself for me, because I mentioned to you that if Kopitar wins a cup in Chicago, like, think about how much more famous and appreciated he is. But he won it in L.A., and people are like, wait, and guess what? Didn't get a Conn Smythe. So people are like, it's the Quick. Like, we go back in history, and you're like, it's Jonathan Quick. And I know it's a joke, but Feud always says, I always thank Quick for my cups. I'm like, you should also take Kopitar. Like, he should also, he should be right there front and center when you thank the two guys based on those productions. But, and then I will say, Reinhardt and Verhaeghe, I throw in there though, because I think Reinhardt is supposed to be like now a lock it down guy for Team Canada. I don't think he's going to be a Hall of Famer, but Verhaeghe had, I think, 74 goals in the last 2 years. Like, they were lumped in together, but I viewed them as just Florida's deep and they've got these awesome guys. The number one guy I think that got saved by all of this is Tkachuk. Because if they lose this cup, McDavid has eaten his lunch in a couple of massive series. He runs from Calgary to Florida, and McDavid still chases him down and beats him, and he gets 2 points in the series, and one of them is on a, you know, gift giveaway that ends up on his tape that he scores. It's the only goal he gets in the series. I thought Tkachuk got saved huge.
Family legacy.
Family, everything, dude.
Think
was
about that.
Massive for him.
How long is Keith? Keith played for 20 years and never won a Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
And I still think I heard that show, it was a great show, but I still thought Chucky was number one. And Chucky's a boy of mine. I love him.
Yeah, number one.
And I have him number one because his family.
That's
think
fair.
About if he would have blown a 3-0 series lead and his father had played 20 years, and now he gets there finally. Mm-hmm. I thought it was for his family's legacy in the game is why it made it bigger than anyone else's legacy. Chucky's going to the Hall of Fame no matter what, I think. Mm. And his father's in the Hall of Fame. His brother may be there one day. I don't know. He's probably the one that would be close. But the family legacy of winning the Stanley Cup, of a family that produces hockey players that has never won it and was this close, I thought Tkachuk was number one on that list for me.
It's a fair case. It really is. I had him high. I had him three, I thought. But, yeah, maybe there was a higher case. I really didn't think he was good in that series. Like, I really didn't.
And he wasn't at his best.
No, and even in that game, like, you know, he had the one play. He gets a puck right on the stick in the slot, and he just tips it right in the goaltender. And I was just like, man, you kind of have the puck more in this game than you've had all series. But also, it's never threatening.
And he rushed that play at the side of the net and flipped it over the net.
Yeah,
that Chucky normally doesn't do. But, like, think about that, though, for him. In the Stanley Cup Finals, you're up 3-0. Now, all of a sudden, the tide's turning, momentum shifting, beliefs building for Edmonton. You know, you think about I'm sure he's thinking about, you know, his old man, you know, like wanting to win it for him, wanting to win it for his family. I mean, his grandparents, like everyone who supported his dad for 20 years, now they're there. And now it's like, so I could understand him gripping the stick tight, too, in this series.
I think he did. I think he was like the number one purpose. Even there was a scrum he got into with, I think it was Janmark, and they both get taken out for the penalties. It goes 4-on-4. And Janmark was like punching him in the face, looking. I really like Janmark too. He's out of all the like winners of this series in terms of guys whose stock I'm way higher on. Janmark is like one of the highest role player guys of this entire thing. He's nasty, huge goals, not afraid PK. Of a scrum, like can skate.
PK.
Yeah. PK, all of it.
Unreal.
All of it. So he gets into a scrum with Tkachuk, and Tkachuk looked like he wanted almost no part of it. And Janmark looked like he was in his kitchen. And I went, damn, Tkachuk is off. Like, this is a bad sign when Matthias Janmark looks like not only is he scoring way bigger goals than you, but he's in your face and he's taken away the, like, who's the impact rat in the series. So that was a big one for me.
You know who it kind of reminds me of a little bit, and he was my teammate, was Hossa in 2010. He's one of the top three players I've ever played with.
I was going to say, this is a huge comparison, but okay.
Well, and like, I know they're semi-different players. One's more power and speed. One's more below the dots. Sure. Actually, they both play below the dots. But when Hossa played in the Stanley Cup Finals against Philly, he did score that big goal in game two. It was a massive goal. But really, you could see it throughout his game, throughout the entirety of the series. He didn't have his best series because he'd been to two Stanley Cup Finals in the previous 2 years. And then we're up 2-0. And then you start to grip the stick tight. And then he takes that penalty, I think it was at the end of game six. And then the puck goes off his shin pad in the net to tie the game. So we go to overtime. And I felt similar to the Tkachuk situation, just in the sense of his old man and the family legacy and what's all weighing on him.
Yeah.
Those are hard moments to play through, man. Like, and those guys had to do it, but they did it better. And then the next time they go to the Cup, so Hossa in 2013, before he got hurt in game six, and then in 2015, he dominates. It was just like a weight of the world was lifted off his shoulders. So I could see a guy like Tkachuk ever get into the finals again, where he definitely takes over now because the weight of the world's lifted off his shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Last thing, speaking of dads, you cry during Maurice's speech?
A little bit.
I got a little choked up. I was like, damn.
My wife did.
I didn't full cry, but my throat was like, I had the like hard burn where if I was watching it with other people and if someone would have been like, that was pretty good, I'd have been like, yeah.
It was a Marley and me burn.
Yeah, that was a real deep burn. I went, and right after, I was like, I tweeted, I'm so happy for Paul Maurice. I actually was never a Maurice hater when he was here in Toronto. I know some people don't like that he waxes poetic all the time, but I think the guy coaches with passion, and I've always been, like, you can just tell how much he loves the game. I've always been a fan. I'm really happy for him.
And I know, you know, Andrew Ladd, who's a very close friend of mine, absolutely, he can't speak high enough of Paul Maurice and what he's done for him in his career and, you know, the leadership he showed him and, you know, just the knowledge for the game. So I know a lot of guys that have played for Paul and they have nothing but great things to say. You do talk about the wax poetically. Yeah. Sometimes you're sitting.
Yeah, every once in a while you gotta roll your eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. But
but I'm a wax poetic guy, so when I see it, I'm like, I get it. I know. You went too long, buddy.
I get it. You know, if I have a couple beers at the table, people are telling me to shut up too. So
yeah, that's exactly it. Is you think you're going on something great, and then all of a sudden you start looking around, and you know that you've lost people's attention. And you're like, oh crap, I'm drinking too much. I said too much. I think Maurice knows what it feels like to do that. Like that would be my guess. Yeah. That would be my guess. Hey, buddy, it was a great season. Always enjoyed getting your perspective. Probably have you on to chat about whatever goes down with this offseason stuff with the Leafs. It's going to start to heat up. Elliot, I think, what did Elliot say during the game yesterday? He says it's going to be bananas this week. So, God,
I saw that. And I listened to the Frank take yesterday, so I'm interested to see how things all shake out here in Leafland.
Yeah, I can't wait. I hope it is bananas. I hope it's a zoo. All right, buddy, talk to you soon. See you, Paul. Christopher Stieg, two-time Stanley Cup champion again, and clever app creator, also part of Quench, which I'm drinking right now. Let's take a quick break. Big extensions and big blown leads.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
A lot was happening yesterday. It's the Stanley Cup Final, Game 7. And teams in the NHL are making trades and rumored Joe Woll extensions. I tweeted about it. Go to my Instagram, Twitter, at JD Bunkus. Reach out anytime. I enjoy it. Love when people... Even sometimes the haters, which I've got a lot of for my McDavid tweet. But a couple big ones in Toronto. Let's start with Scotty Barnes.
Adrian Wojnarowski reported yesterday that the Raptors and Scotty Barnes have reached an agreement on a 5-year rookie extension that could pay Scotty up to $270 million. The extension would begin next season with a starting salary of about $39 million, but that could go up to $51 million by the time it gets to 2030, which sounds so weird to even say.
Yeah.
But unless he qualifies, so he could qualify this season if he makes an All-NBA team, Defensive Player of the Year, or MVP. Yeah. Those numbers will get higher. Barnes plans to actually sign the extension when the league's moratorium is lifted on July 6th.
So Barnes signed a 5-year, $270 million contract is what I need there. I'll tell you this. Blake did a great write-up on sportsnet.ca. So go check out Blake Murphy's. It's on his Twitter and Instagram right now. It's also on sportsnet.ca. So if you want the like deep intricacy details of this thing, you can get them there. But essentially, the Coles notes is he's making 25% of the Raptors cap. And yeah, the cap's going to go up by small percentages year over year, but it's a big contract. They took advantage of a clause that allows the Raptors to give him an extra year early out of his rookie deal, but they paid him a ton of money to do so. And this is my major takeaway. Well, there's two things. One is there's really no take on, overpay. This is the cost of doing business now in the NBA. This is what it's going to take to get a guy like Scotty Barnes to re-sign with your franchise. You tell him, hey, you're the face of the franchise. We're moving Siakam for literally nothing. We're trading OG. You're the face of the franchise, man. We're going as far as you're going. So I don't really care that he got a big contract because it's expected that he was going to get a big contract. And yes, the number of the cap is going to escalate drastically. And so you see that figure, and it's pretty eye-popping, but that's going to be just about everybody moving forward. There's going to be worse players than Scotty Barnes that sign those deals. That said, it is a reminder that the Raptors are kind of in a rebuild. And guys are already making money.
Yeah.
Like, RJ Barrett's making money. Quickly's about to get $20 million a year. They got Poeltl making $20 million a year. Now they're going to make Scotty Barnes making 25% of the cap. It's sort of an odd feeling that the Raptors are in a position that you would sort of think, okay, it's not a pure teardown rebuild, but I would say it's supposed to be kind of similar to where OKC was a year ago, right? You're kind of hoping that maybe one more year where they don't succeed and they grab one more co-pilot and you end up with a bunch of high-end players. I don't think Barnes is going to be as good as Shea, but let's say that he's the Shea in the situation and that quickly ends up being your Jalen Williams. And then you're hoping maybe to get a guy in the draft that's your Chet and you're filling it out with other guys. Your Cason Wallace is your Grady Dick. You know, you're hoping to build out a team like the Celtics have. You're hoping to draft and develop because you ain't doing it in free agency ever anyway. But you're certainly, you know, you're not grabbing some free agents now because your cap situation isn't great. So it's just something of note to say, hey, the Raptors are a team that was stuck in the middle for a couple of years, didn't do very well with trading of some of their assets, and now is already looking at a potential rebuild, not a tear down, where all of their young guys are already on big ticket deals. Like quickly, there's no, you know, it's Grady Dick. There's no other player on the team that's making sweetheart money for the next couple of years. So that's my only thought on it. It sucks that they don't really have a lot of flexibility and that they're already kind of flirting with the luxury tax. You go, but you stink. You know, haven't done much. So, and I also think that him getting the 30% of the cap, if all things go well, if he becomes an all-NBA type talent, you're just happy that he gets there. I don't think that's going to be a problem. I don't think he's going to do enough winning to hit that escalator as soon as next year. And I also just look at the depth of field in the NBA right now, of how many good players there are, and the fact that we've gone away from just traditional this spot. And I don't really see Scottie Barnes' path, at least in the next couple of seasons, to make it an all-NBA team.
He squeezed into the All-Star game last year.
Yeah,
right?
But so even then, the only reason he got 30 into the All-Star game is because they didn't want to put too many Celtics. Like, he was already a replacement, and it was a political move. So, yeah. What's next? Oh, yeah, the Jays. I'll just handle this. Jays, I had it second screen yesterday, and it was perfect because I'm barely paying attention. Like, I was grinning watching hockey. I was very into the hockey game. But every once in a while, it was a commercial break. I'm kind of, like, glancing over, and Jays are down 2-1. I'm going, like, of course they're down. Of course they're losing. Whatever. As Zimbarger gets on base, all of a sudden, bang, the Jays are rolling. They go up 6-2. I'm like, damn, they went up 6-2. All right. What's the bullpen situation going to be like here? They get Bassett to go through 7. They need 2 innings of work from this nightmare of a bullpen, which, like, people can say you got the injuries to Jimmy and to Romano, but it was bad all season, and Romano was bad all season, and Jimmy was really the only good bullpen arm. And people made fun of me when I said this in the offseason, and when the season started, was I never really liked the pen. I didn't like the shape that it was in, and people went, don't worry, Swanson's going to come back. I was like, all right. TV dinner came back, and he served him up. They're a nightmare. Nate Pearson came in. I think that this was a 2 screw-up situation because I watched the meltdown. First of all, it is funny that we've been praising these, like, young guys that have come up that can play multiple positions because it's like, yeah, whatever, they're found money. But none of them can play defense. Like, Barger drops a pop fly out. Horowitz double clutches a routine ground ball that needs to get over. Like, obviously needs to get over. Kiermaier's I'm more forgiving of because he's usually brilliant, but yeah, he has a ball go off his forearm. Like, that's a play you got to make. You're Kevin Kiermaier. You're hitting, you know, sub Mendoza line, I'm pretty sure, or at least close. You got to make a defensive play. And he doesn't. So there were 3 plays defensively that were woof moments. So some relief to the bullpen. But I also think John Schneider, kind of an idiotic move, going from Pearson to get a lefty matchup with Mesa against Devers. I went, why? What has Tim Mesa shown you ever in this season to justify him getting that spot over Pearson, who at least can throw it 100? Give me Nate Pearson 10 million times out of a million. I don't care what the splits are. And he takes him out, and predictably, Mesa gives up the ball game. He goes to Zach Pop, throws 1 meatball, bang, first pitch, game tied. It was a masterclass in bad bullpen, bad defense, bad managing, and that's your Toronto Blue Jays, baby. 7 straight losses. Now I'm looking at the standings saying, maybe they should just tank. God. Subscribe to this podcast, leave 5 stars, follow on Twitter and Instagram @JD Bunkus. We'll see you tomorrow.